5042, and we will just allow you to take up where you left off and continue presentation.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Leslie Halleck. I'm the Provost or Chief Academic Officer of Oregon Health and Science University. What I want to do today is, first of all, very briefly orient you as to the material we'll be presenting and the order in which we'll be presenting it, just to kind of let everyone know what we're doing. The first thing that I need to tell you is that we are giving you material, and I don't know if it's actually in front of you. There's a packet of materials. There should be a yellow piece of paper on top of them. And that is the material that should go in tab 3 and should actually replace what's in tab 3. You can take that out. We'll recycle it for you later. But if you would replace what's in tab 3, what we've done to try and make your life a little simpler, it's the same material, but it'll follow now in the order of our presentations. And I think it'll be a little easier to track. And so if you would just take that loose packet and replace the material behind tab 3 with the loose material that we just gave you, it'll help.
Steve, did you get those directions?
Put it behind tab 3.
If I may just interject, the people who left their notebooks here, Dolores has already done that. So these, if you took your notebook with you and I'm bringing it back now, please, as Dr. Halleck is saying, there are replacement materials.
Thank you. Tab 3. What we would like to do in terms of the order of the remaining presentations today and tomorrow is the following, if it meets with your approval. The first thing that I will do is spend a few moments, probably 5 or 10 minutes, giving a high-level overview of kind of our budget realities, try and answer a couple of questions that came up yesterday. And then, because there was so much interest and you know, because it's a complicated subject in terms of the impact of some of the reimbursements, particularly Medicaid, on how our overall institution operates, we thought we would follow then with the clinical programs and then switch to the educational programs. So what we'll do after the overview is let you hear from the hospitals and clinics, the director of the hospitals and clinics and the chief financial officer of the hospitals and clinics are here with us today, and we'll have a brief presentation from them and the materials all in your hands, and go through the sort of Medicaid impacts and just in a high level, but so you can see exactly what's happened over time and how it affects us. And then I will introduce the director of the Child Development and Rehabilitation Center, another organization within OHSU which has a kind of a micro cosm of all of our missions. It has a clinical service delivery arm. It also has training and research in it, but it's a separate entity and has a separate budget history. So we'll give you a little bit of information about that. And after that, we'll have concluded the clinical programs, and I'll begin the instructional programs and talk about the educational mission and how the state funds it and what the state funds and what the impacts are of various budget decisions, and try and give you a feeling for all the health profession educational programs. Finally, and I expect that I won't finish that today, that will spill over until tomorrow. I'd like to conclude that with a budget model we internally have called the capitation model. I think perhaps a friendlier and better term is a student-based budget model, and tell you how that works, not in terrible detail, but you have all the detail in your book, but at a high level, so you can really easily see what I call the hydraulics of what buys what in terms of health professional students. And then finally end by coming back to the research mission and the Oregon opportunity and take up the conversation from yesterday again about the impact of the opportunity and the impact of various decisions, so you can see clearly, at least from our view, how that would play out. Does that make sense in terms of an order for everyone?
I think you have a very workable plan.
Okay, thank you very much. All right, to quickly recap some of the revenue elements, and I won't dwell on the ones that President Kohler mentioned, this is the overall budget for the current fiscal year, FY2003. We tend to talk in terms of single years rather than biennial. Since we became a public corporation, we budget annually, and so if I confuse the two, I'll try and be very clear what I'm talking about, but generally it's an annual budget. that shows the various elements that make up our revenue sources, the orange being the state appropriation, which is 4.3 of the whole Oregon Health and Science University budget. This just gives you a visual of the history since 1987 of the total revenue. The purple represents the hospital, and the university is the lighter orange. So roughly half of the activity, actually now it's more close, approaching 60%, 55% is the hospital activity on either a revenue or a budget basis. This is the state appropriation history. Now, here I have used biennial figures since the biennium just preceding the public corporation. We could go back further if you have an interest, but we thought this was probably the easiest way to capture the current situation. You can see the total biennial budget from 93-95, the biennium just before the public corporation was enabled by Senate Bill 2, and then carrying forward in successive biennia. The arrangement, the promise we made when the public corporation was approved, was that we would come back in 95, the next biennium, having taken the final phase-in of Measure 5, as Mr. Bender mentioned yesterday, that's the drop from 123 to 106, without eliminating any programs. And we did that. And we also promised that in the successive, in biennium immediately following that, we would not ask for more money. And we did that, actually much to the surprise of some of the people who heard us. So in 97-99, we did not ask for additional funds. There was a little bit of extra money put into the Southwest AHEC program, and that's the difference there. But in general, we came in with a flat budget request. In 99-01, we came back and said we can't forever sustain the same programs without an inflationary increase, and we've done what we agreed to, but we need to make a policy decision at this point as to whether we continue all the programs or they are funded. And the increase from 97-99 to 99-01 amounted to approximately what in those days was called the, I'm not supposed to use the term current service level, I know I've been advised, but in those days that's exactly what was used in. But it wasn't an inflationary increase. It was designated by the legislature for nursing, dentistry, and AHEC. That amounts to a very small portion of our budget. So for those programs, it was very nice. It was very helpful because they hadn't seen an inflationary increase in a long time. But it did not give any increase to medicine, which is two-thirds of the academic budget. But it gave some help to the programs that were most dependent on state dollars. And then in the continuing last session, 01-03, you can see that we took a substantial reduction. Now, that represents some of the successive changes that have occurred since the session closed. Now, you can see how it's distributed internally. Between the Ed and General budget, that is the schools, and you'll be hearing about that at the end of today and into tomorrow, and the hospital, which is the light orange, and the CDRC, the Child Development and Rehabilitation Center, and you'll hear from them today. That's how that budget has been allocated over these biennia.
Dr. Halleck, over the interim, there was discussion about a MUPL program that OHSU had initiated with the federal government. Where is that on this? Does it show up on your total revenue anywhere?
It doesn't show up on the total revenue, but I'll show you. It will show up in just a minute. Let me not flip around too fast here. There's a slide on which it will show up in just a couple of slides.
I'll bear with you then.
If you could, and then you'll see exactly how it plays in. And in particular, you'll see the detail of that in a slide that the health system will show you in even more detail exactly where it occurred. And you'll be able to see where Medicaid and Medicare, especially Medicaid, where there was an increase in funding and then a drop again. So you'll see those numbers very precisely in just a moment. The research awards we discussed yesterday, President Kohler described the increase in research. Since he's not sitting up here, I can embarrass him a little bit. He came in 1988, and this is essentially the span of time over which he's been the president at at OHSU, and we're very proud, actually, of the accomplishments in research that have occurred. Just to give you a little bit of an indicator, in 1986, we were number 87 in NIH funding out of 2,000 institutions in the country. We're now number 29. So we're ranked at a much higher level just in terms of relative NIH funding, which is the predominant federal agency that funds our research programs.
Could I ask a question about that, too?
Sure.
In light of what's going on with a lot of federal programs where they're scaling back in order to address the military issues and the homeland security issues, have you had a discussion about how that is going to impact your government granting?
Many discussions. And actually, the impact is potentially very positive, and let me explain why. The NIH budget, as a result of the hard work of Senator Hatfield and some others, was projected to double over a five-year period. That doubling is just now completed, and we've done well in that environment where the NIH budget was increasing. It has held its own this year, and one of the reasons that's very interesting is the Homeland Security dollars that have been added to the federal budget or allocated within the federal budget have not all gone into defense agencies. One of the really exciting opportunities for OHSU, and it's sort of an odd thing, but a very sizable amount, $1.5 billion, was put into an institute of NIH called Allergies and Infectious Diseases. And I'm an aging virologist, I confess, so you touched a button here. But what happened is that because there are emerging infections, both from global travel and from protection needs against potential weapons, it's been recognized that there's an enormous lack of vaccines, basically, against a lot of these elements. So they've funneled a fair bit of money in an unusual, I mean, this is not usually how this happens, into the NIH, specifically for research in vaccine development. As it happens, in the 90s, we positioned ourselves, we started an institute called the Vaccine Gene Therapy Institute and recruited immunologists who have just the sort of expertise they need to develop these vaccines. So we've just submitted grant applications for new initiatives out of the National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases that amount to $47 million in program, $30 million for one kind of facility, and $140 million for another kind of facility in which to do this work. We don't know if we'll receive those, but there's suddenly more resources in the vaccine arena, which is an area where we have a great deal of expertise. So, you know, in the long run, things will continuously reshuffle. For example, the Oregon Graduate Institute receives a fair bit of money from DARPA, another agency that's often funded for things like robotics and other things that are of interest to the defense industry, computer science kinds of applications. So one of the ways you have to approach this is you have to figure out what they're funding and see if you have the expertise. But as it happens, we do in several of the key areas where we think we can contribute scientifically.
So how do you deal with the issue of mission creep if you're chasing available grant dollars?
Well, you certainly can't chase those that aren't appropriate for your mission. And that's very good counsel, and you have to be very careful. As it happens, certainly fighting infectious diseases is extremely appropriate for our mission. So it's something, regardless of 9/11 and long before it, we had begun to develop. In that, in the 90s, we really developed it to try and work toward an AIDS vaccine. And so, but the same skill sets apply to a variety of viruses. The other thing, so you have to guard against that. You absolutely have to guard against that. But one of the reasons that we think we're very well positioned to be able to do some good work here is that a third of the population is called basically vulnerable in the context of vaccines. Elderly, infants, pregnant women don't actually respond all that well to vaccines. Well, we've built, aside from 9/11, a cadre of people to address that. How can you make these things more effective so that they protect the population? So we see that the vaccine development is really part and parcel of our mission in terms of research. But if it weren't, you wouldn't want to chase those. It would be very distracting and not appropriate.
Sorry to derail you.
No.
So please proceed.
Okay. Now, I'm going to try and address a question that came up yesterday, and I've kind of distilled it down to a little bit simpler chart here. And I didn't go back very far because it is a confusing situation. But we talked a little bit about the university side deficit and the hospital profit. It isn't really profit, but a positive bottom line that if you were an independent business would allow you to invest in upgrading your plant, basically to buy equipment and capitalize your operation. But it's important for you to see that the hospital, which is the lighter color, is in fact a positive, but the university side has always been underfunded. And one of the things that our board has directed us to do over the next 3 to 5 years is to bring that university budget into balance, which means we shouldn't be carrying more program than we can afford. Now, I think you can see just from these 3 years the trajectory we're on, and I want to reassure you that the budget in 03 and the projected budget for 04, which we're actually building right now, is in keeping with the direction of the purple bars on here. That is, we're reducing the cost, the net cost of all of our academic programs. And at the same time, I don't want to be Pollyannish. I want to mention that although our five-year improvement plan that the board approved shows the hospital next year making $36 million, that is before the Medicaid reductions that we talked about yesterday. So there's another, and you'll see, but there, what's not shown here is about $19 million in losses that will have to be incorporated into that $36 million if nothing changes. So even if that were the case, though, we're still balanced overall, and we're on a path that creates more self-sufficiency for the academic program that 5 years, really 3 years out now, will in fact balance. It won't make money, but we should be able to break even on the academic programs. That doesn't mean it's a great thing to do from an academic point of view, because there are some programs that you will have to eliminate because you can't afford to carry them if that's the public policy decision. And we'll try and be very clear about what those decisions are so you can see them. I don't know if that helps at all in terms of some of the questions that came up last time.
Representative Bates,
Madam Chair, there's three ways to go about balancing out a program like this. One is to become more efficient. One is to raise more funds. And the third, and the least one we want to use, is cut programs.
Right.
You've got immediately to cutting programs. I find that somewhat disconcerting.
Understandable, and I don't want to mislead you. We are doing all of those. I'll give you an example. During the last round of implementations as a result of the $10 million reduction in our operating budget that came out of the 01 legislative session, one of the things we did in the allied health arena was restructure the programs in medical technology and in paramedic emergency medicine service programs, where we didn't have to eliminate them at all. We were able to save them, and in fact, we have increased their enrollment. And we did that with three-way partnerships in the paramedic program with the fire district and Oregon Institute of Technology, and everyone brought everything they had to bear on this program, which essentially made it more efficient, and we were able to protect the program. So I completely agree. Wherever we can enhance revenue, we obviously will. Unfortunately, in an educational program, that tends to mean tuition. In some cases, we've been able to bring in clinical or training grant dollars, and that helps enormously. And I'll show you as I build the budget model for the educational programs at the end of today and into tomorrow exactly where that works and where it doesn't work. There unfortunately are a few programs where it's very difficult to put revenue in them. Now, some of those you can protect anyway because you need them to have a well-rounded health science education. In others, there may be other institutions that can perform that function. Dental hygiene is an example there, where although we certainly didn't want to eliminate it, we felt that our core mission was the dental school and training dentists, and that our graduates of the dental hygiene program made up 30% of the state's graduates. The other 70 were actually in the community college training settings. So we weren't closing the only program in the state, which we would have been in the medical technology of the paramedic, advanced paramedic training program. So that's how we tried to balance it. We're the only provider, where we're the core, it's the core, we try and protect it.
Rep Bates, you look like you need a follow-up here.
Yes, Madam Chair, I kind of looked ahead, and we're going to be talking more about the education programs towards the end of this session, and I think I'll wait and hold my questions until then.
Representative Bates.
I absolutely share that, though it's been very painful to go through this. We've so far managed to protect all the ones that are unique to OHSU. You know, we'll
continue the presentation. We're taking up time. And
all right. I want to just point out the changes in the revenue sources between the last biennium and this. And so far, we've been able to make up the revenue in terms of other sources, as the state was less able to provide that. The hospital is particularly acute, and you can see that the state provision has gone from 3.2% to 1.2% of the entire budget for the hospital in terms of revenue. And again, the leveraging argument will come back in different forms in terms of what leverage is accomplished by those state dollars, but is very strategic in terms of what is funded by the state. And I'll come back to that in the context of each program. I'm old enough to refer to this diagram as Pac-Man diagram internally, and we update it periodically. But it's meant to show you that we have a lot of different kinds of programs, and that the state dollars are not spread evenly across them. The blue represents state investment in our programs. And I think you can see that there are some programs that are more dependent on state investment than others. And an example of that would be the School of Nursing. They have fewer opportunities to raise revenue than physicians, for example. And so they're more dependent on a percentage basis on the investment from the state in being able to respond to the looming nursing crisis. And that's why in the 99 biennial allocation, they were one of the earmarked programs. And similarly, dentistry. Now, dentistry isn't quite as dependent, but it's close. They have the ability to raise a little clinical revenue in the dental clinic, and that helps fund the dental program, as you'll see when we bring the numbers. So you can see that the different programs, the volume is one example of our research institutes which receive no state dollars. So they vary depending on the different programs. The CROWIT, I'll just mention, actually receives dollars from a different source than the general fund. That comes out of workman's compensation dollars. So that's why it's a different color up there. So I just wanted to give you a little bit of a flavor of the different kinds of programs and the different ways the state partners with us. And then what I'd like to do now is turn to the hospitals and clinics and have a little bit more discussion with you, in particular by Peter Rapp, who's the new director of the hospitals and clinics, and Aaron Crane, the chief financial officer, about some of the dynamics of the reimbursement environment we find ourselves in. But before I do, are there questions of a general sense on the general overall financial picture that I could answer?
Apparently not.
Okay.
You're going to operate for me?
I will if you want me to.
That's great.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Madam Chairman, I am Peter Rapp, Executive Director of the Hospitals and Clinics at OHNSU, and I appreciate the opportunity to make a few comments to the committee this morning. If it pleases you, I would like to take a couple of minutes to first make an observation or two on the distinct role that OHSU Hospital and Clinics occupies, and then immediately go to some of the distinct impact that our current reimbursement environment is creating on that ability to deliver that role, and then share with you some thoughts about strategies that we are pursuing. Before, I guess I have a unique opportunity this morning, and having been a relatively new member of the team, having the objectivity and the ability to not take any credit for any of the success on our next slide, if I could get my, but I think if we talk distinct role, it's very difficult to talk about the context of OHSU without acknowledging some of the very important accomplishments that have been developing there. As Leslie has pointed out, through revenue numbers, the scope and scale of services at OHSU Hospital and Clinics has grown dramatically since the mid-90s through the faculty recruitment and programmatic investments and facility expansions that leadership has created. It also is a site that represents one of the most acute and intense patient care environments in the country. Medicare has a vehicle called Case Mix Index, or an acronym of CMI that we refer to, that is a proxy, if you will, for the complexity of cases that we treat. And if you look at our patient base. It is among the highest of academic medical centers around the country. So besides growth, there's intensity and complexity that's developed nicely at the institution over the last few years. We're busy as a single site. We're the busiest hospital in the state. We're pleased that the consumers who have come to us assess it and evaluate us as a top provider. And we're not we don't treat lightly the responsibility as a large employer with 4,200 employees that we represent a major employment base for the Metro Portland area. So with that success and distinct role in mind, I'd like to shift, if we could, to the next role, which is, I think, more direct to your focus this morning. And that speaks to the distinct role as safety net provider for Medicaid and self-pay, the underinsured populations in the state of Oregon. What this chart represents is an attempt on our part to take a look at the average percentage of the population that is Medicaid and self-pay in each county in each area of the state, and then look at the percentage of Medicaid discharges that we service in each of those counties. And as you can see through the shading in the chart, the most darkly shaded counties, Portland Metro and some selected others, represent a service to those counties at over twice the rate of the average Medicaid population rate for each of those counties. So OHSU discharges at twice the Medicaid and self-pay rate for the Portland Metro area and Coos County. In the more lightly shaded counties, we are between one and two times the average rate. So, for example, in Crook County, we are between one and two times what their average Medicaid rate is. So we represent really a safety net resource for the state in a broad-based way, and that's been a historical role that we've been able to maintain that is key to who we are. In a different view, if you take a look at Portland Metro, about 45% of our discharges are Medicaid and self-pay. And as we look at both the average discharge rate around the state or our other major delivery systems in the Portland metro area, you can see that a disproportionate amount of our mission and capacity has really been directed towards the ability to continue and support that those populations and missions. It's a major part of the capacity that we provide to the state, and it has been historically. We need to then shift then to really the impact on the current environment, and I'd like to walk through a couple of slides that have a lot of numbers, but I think creates the focus of what is the economic impact on our delivery capability then in the context of the current cuts and as we understand them as they're rolling forward. We have estimated through the categories of cuts that have been identified to date that by the end of June 30 this fiscal year, we will have revenue reductions of $5.3 million of revenue. It comes through key areas. The acuity, the major impact on us, as you can imagine, with our clinics, our emergency department services, and so forth, is the elimination of the presumptive eligibility provision. We start service immediately, and if patients are not immediately eligible for Medicaid reimbursement, those services will go in an unreimbursed fashion until eligibility is determined. We've estimated that at $2.3 million this year, but on an annualized basis, over $7 million for fiscal year 04. The $19 million that Leslie or Dr. Halleck mentioned a few minutes ago is our forecast. If you look at the right-hand column in fiscal year 04, all of the cuts as proposed will total a $19 million revenue reduction to our performance next year, and that's the adjustment that she mentioned a few minutes ago as you look at our forecast looking forward. Our acuity is distinctly affects us, and I think disproportionately in our outlier provision. I think, as the committee probably knows, outliers are those high-cost, more complex cases that supplemental reimbursement mechanisms were in place for in the Medicaid program. Those have been eliminated as part of the rollbacks and therefore go directly to the kind of patient population and service that we deliver. We are not dealing just with Medicaid reductions. It is a complex environment, and what we wanted to try to show in the next chart was to focus on all of our public payer relationships and funding sources. and how do they affect our overall performance. We historically have had some element of cross-subsidy, if you will. Public payer Medicare and Medicaid representing low reimbursement payers. Deficits or margins then that need to be made up in different ways. One of the ways, as you know, is cost shifting to those who can pay and afford to pay. That's a traditional vehicle in the healthcare industry. What we want to show you with this chart is the risk, and as the environment moves forward, how those individual payer groups are playing out at OHSU. Madam Chairman, the question you asked a few minutes ago about MUPL payments, if you look at Medicaid numbers here for 2001 and 2002, represents that block of time where those funds were available. And as you can see, what we're projecting and what we're seeing through the cuts is not only for Medicaid, but as we project the volumes and costs associated with non-sponsored patient volume growth and the Medicare program changes that are occurring through Washington, that we are projecting in 2003 and escalating through 2005 potential deficits on the patient service activity for these categories of patients of ranging from 23 up to close to $50 million a year. These deficits represent a direct threat to our ongoing viability, and so we are responding to those with strategies. And let me comment on those. And Madam Chairman, Representative Bates, your comment a minute ago about strategies goes right to the heart of the kind of activities that we're focused on. We're focused in several areas. One is revenue-generating activities, and we're doing that through several different ways. One is just the operating mechanisms within our institution to assure we do a great job of capturing and billing correctly. But we will also be facing pricing and rate schedule adjustments to the private sector that will be on a scale much larger than what we've seen historically. So we're estimating, as we look forward into next...
Representative Bates.
I don't want to interrupt your train of thought, but
That's fine.
A couple of questions we have along that I'd like to ask.
Yes, sir.
Referring back to your net loss on under-reimbursed patients, you have listed fourth line down state support. Exactly how you use that state support. Is that a Medicaid match?
I can address that, Madam Chair, Representative Bates. That represents the portion of the...
Identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, for the record, I'm Aaron Crane, Chief Financial Officer for the Hospitals and Clinics. This represents the piece of the state appropriation funding that comes to the university that's identified for the hospital. So we took that and just reflected it on here as compensation toward this underserved population. We're just trying to represent the scale of the appropriation we receive with the losses that we're sustaining in that population.
Well, Madam Chair... do you use that money for a Medicaid match?
Oh, I'm sorry. No, we don't.
So what exactly do you use the money for?
Well, it offsets the cost of care. I mean, if you've got a patient that has no insurance, we provide care to that patient. It helps absorb the funding. And then basically it's salary cost, it's technology cost, it's pharmaceutical cost, all that.
If it was used for Medicaid match, you got a 2-1 match for it, and got a better reimbursement rate for your Medicaid patients, would that be of value to you?
We are using other funds for Medicaid match. We are running through IGT several things around disproportionate share and indirect medical education costs. So we are working very dutifully with the OMAP leadership in all areas where we can do match, and we are bringing significant dollars into the program for that.
Madam Chair, I would ask that at a later time, when we have a little more time, you and I sit down and talk about ways let's say, recycling this money to get that 2-1 match. I hate to see general fund money going into OHSU using straight as general fund money when you are so grossly underpaid for your Medicaid patients, and you have such a huge number of Medicaid patients compared to other hospitals. I just think it's you're working here on a very unequal field, and for having money just go straight in, if there's any way to make that Medicaid match and triple that money or almost triple the money for you, it's the way to go. Maybe we can talk about it. You may have explored every possible avenue already, and I suspect you have, but let's talk about it.
You welcome the opportunity. Great.
Later time. I don't take up committee time for that.
Representative Bates, I think it would be interesting for the committee to follow OHSU's thought on why that isn't used as Medicaid match. And so I would hope that you, in the short term, have your conversation and that the results of that become part of this presentation.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'll make sure that happens.
Please proceed.
Thank you.
And I've got a question.
Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. On the slide you're presently on, you've got a statement of cost of health care will increase 10 to 15% in the private sector. We have grappled with the rising cost of health care in this state and across the nation, and had a difficult time getting the reasons out for that, whether it's high tech, greater utilization, pharmaceutical costs, and you can name a dozen others. Some of us are beginning to think that it's none of those, that in fact what we're seeing the last 2 years is a shift into the commercial market of cost because of more people having no insurance and under reimbursement by Medicare and Medicaid, and we're getting a suspicion that that may be the key driver. We have not been able to get a hold of those figures. So my question is, in your system, you may have figured this out. You're saying that you expect a 10 to 15% increase in the private sector because of state funding reductions. And I'd like to hear a little bit more about how you got those figures and what you think those figures mean.
Madam Chairman, Representative Bates, let me speak to it. I think there are a number of factors you've listed off. Many labor was not on your list. It's another important one with manpower shortages and constraints and the market price for labor that's in place that is also creates pressure on hospital performance, and we're certainly experiencing that. I would have to answer that I think it's a combination of all of those. This previous slide on unreimbursed patients and the subsidy and the cross-subsidy that's associated with all of those, that volume certainly is a major factor in our ability to perform on an ongoing basis. We're also faced with the balance with the marketplace and being able to continue to attract and participate in paying patients to OHSU just as other providers are. So the working and responding to payers and employers who are paying the bills on the other side of this issue and finding where we can remain competitive in that marketplace is the process that we're going through now. We look at our rates. We look at the rates in town and in the marketplace, and try to make a judgment on how we can balance responding to some of these factors that we've described to you today and still remain as competitive as possible. I'll comment in a minute. A major part of our strategy also relates to the performance improvement kind of objectives that you asked Dr. Halleck about a minute ago, productivity and expense reduction kinds of strategies. So it's not all direct rate pass-through, but there's performance improvement strategies part of our agenda as well.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't make my question clear to you, and I apologize.
Right.
What I'm trying to get to is, do you have any idea, and can you calculate, which you may not be able to do, and I would understand if you couldn't, what the effect on commercial rates at your institution is as a result of under-reimbursement by Medicaid, Medicare, and uninsured patients? That's a very tough question. I realize that. It's one we're not getting good answers to. We're really trying to find out what's causing medical inflation. And some of us are getting suspicious. It's none of the things we thought it was, that, in fact, the cost shift may be the major factor, but we can't get that answer out.
Yeah.
And if you can help us with that, it would be very much appreciated.
Okay.
Is it 2%? Is it 10%? Is it 15%? Because we're expecting anywhere from 10 to 15% annual increase in health care rates, cost of health care in this country. We don't know why.
Yeah,
if I might just interject, too, this is a point of discussion that's been ongoing in the audit committee since the beginning of session, with trying to grapple with the level of care that we as a state can afford to provide in the Medicaid program. And I think that I sense Representative Bates' frustration at not being able to get a handle on
right.
this very issue. And our inability to kind of, we have only one small finger to put in the dike here. And it's extremely frustrating for us to try to get a bead on the scope of the problem that we're trying to fix.
I appreciate that. Madam Chairman, let's have our Chief Financial Officer try to speak to that question, too.
Hey, Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I'd be happy to put a slide together to detail my thoughts, but let me quickly give you a sense. And when you look at our budget year next year, as the slide had shown you, about $19 million of budget budget pressure is created in the Medicaid cuts. An additional $6 million is created in the Medicare cuts and reimbursement, and probably $2 to $3 million in increased charity expense. So that's $27 million worth of pressure. The normal inflation, the cost of labor increases and supplies, that's probably in the $3 to $6 million range. So you can see the magnitude of the issue related to those programs is substantially greater than just the inflation, the cost of labor, and supplies. You know, so if you're talking about a 10% rate increase, you can figure two-thirds of that to three-quarters of it relates to this very issue, I'd say. Now, I can get more specific with those assumptions and formally present it, but just wanted to try and respond, you know.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that I would guess that you and I are going to have a conversation.
Look forward to it.
Yeah, I look forward to it, too. I really do. It'll be good for us. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please proceed.
Excuse me.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Marsh.
Pardon me. Thank you, Madam Chair. Since we were on this topic, I was going to ask that you also do a little homework around one of the decisions we may be faced with is, I mean, in the last session we created the OHP plus and OHP standard populations, i.e. the categoricals versus optional populations. We're because of the financial situation, we're looking at a possibility of eliminating all optional populations. And if you could do some calculations as to what your Medicaid population is here, are they, what percentage is Medicaid eligible versus non, and what the effect of that would be on your institution, i.e. the optionals not having coverage, that would be something we'd need to hear.
That's an excellent point, Representative March. I think one of the things that we're grappling with trying to communicate to the members of this process is the cost shift and the kind of three-dimensional dynamic to all of this, and that the cost doesn't just go away when there isn't
right.
money there.
Exactly.
So that would be interesting to have.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. We will do that for you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, then to go back to our strategies, besides our pricing side strategies that we've already spoken about, I must also comment that we are looking at a range of programs, services, and scale that have been provided historically that, in the face of the kind of environment that we're talking about, are not as sustainable or are not likely to continue. We have been aggressively pursuing different vehicles to support parts of our primary care networking capacity to remain accessible, using and exploring federally qualified health centers as other environments that can help create some stability. But part of the focus here is to also identify what is the ongoing distinct service that OHSU can provide to the state as distinguished from other services that can be provided by multiple other providers in the community. And we're kind of working through that. We have significant financial investments in a variety of other services here at Poison Center, a very large interpreter staff and force with the diverse patient population that we serve, for example. We have made adjustments to our policies, historical policies, in our outpatient pharmacies that move us more to the community standard of cash and carry kinds of expectations at the window, and we are moving through reducing and radically reducing the size of our hospital-based dental services program. All of them represent longstanding programs and commitments and direct service delivery to patients that where services are, in theory, available elsewhere in the community and not distinct to OHSU, so we're proceeding on those. Thirdly, I don't want to go without commenting on our focus on productivity and performance improvement. We have just finished a 200 FTE reduction in our payroll. We are looking at productivity improvements and other adjustments that will continue that focus. It's hard to do in this labor market, but we do think that that will continue to be part of our strategy going forward also, is reducing workforce. And we understand that that has an unintended consequence of additional ripples in the economy.
Senator Gordley has a question.
Well, actually, if you could complete your statement, I'd like to go back to an item on the underfunded list.
Madam Chair, would you like to do that now? To the underfunded list?
Senator Gordley?
Right. If you would, please, provide a bit more detail about the interpreter services that are in jeopardy. What specific services? What would the impact be on clients? Why should we be concerned?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, this function is a very important one with a diverse patient base that we have. We have large populations who have very limited or no English-speaking capability. So our interpreters are designed to assure that the care, the communication relationships with providers around their patient care is done in a language and in a clarity that makes sense for the patient, and it allows them to be knowledgeable and make good decisions. The implication here is the ability in a timely way to get access to an interpreter to be a partner in the care process is what will be restricted. It complicates the care management process significantly, as you would imagine, of not being able to understand what your physician or care provider is trying to communicate to you about what your circumstances are or what follow-up requirements you may have and need to participate in. So it's one of those programs that we try to provide if at all possible, but it's our opinion that the scope and scale of that is not going to be sustainable.
Madam Chair, if I may follow up, could you break out the cost of providing those interpreter services so that we have a better feel for exactly what is being jeopardized? And it would seem to me that the provision of those services is also tied to ethical practice. So I need to better understand what's in jeopardy and what the cost would be to keep those services in place. Another part of that question would be, as we look at these programs that are underfunded and in jeopardy, how has the board talked about using its reserves? What are the policies surrounding use of the reserves? And then again, is the board discussing applying any of the reserves to any of these underfunded programs on this list and any other list that we might look at in your presentation?
If I might ask a follow-up question to Senator Gordley's question, I would be interested in knowing when you are looking at the programs that are in jeopardy because of the underfunding situation, you must be looking at some kind of ways to provide some minimal type of service. I'm sure that you're in situations with non-English speaking people where it's very critical that you be able to communicate with them. Can you talk to the committee about the discussions that you're having in the area of being able to provide a minimal level of service?
Madam Chairman, sure. We're an acute care enterprise, and there are a variety of other services that we provided, from ranging from primary care to a variety of ambulatory. I think the guiding principle that we have is, in any of these programs, is that those acute care emergent life-threatening circumstances will be protected and services will be provided. There are a range of relationships with patients that are more elective and discretionary that or less acute that are the areas where we focus and examine: are there resources or activities that are available through other ways in the community that may but will affect the timeliness and accessibility of some of these resources in a real term that we can communicate to our patients on where they can find them elsewhere or how they can get access to them. So what we're trying to do is protect really the emergent life-threatening core services that are unique to what we can provide. There are other vehicles through phone service and less direct vehicles, for example, with interpreter services that folks can access We're trying to make those available and knowledgeable to our patient and clientele and so that they can do that. They're less costly, but they're also less direct and service-based. And so what you're seeing is an erosion of the very personal, direct services through, for instance, in the interpreter, face-to-face, side-by-side kind of support that, frankly, you or I would probably expect as we would go in and present for primary care or any other kind of direct services. These are the things that are at risk. Does that make it clear?
Yes. Thank you. Senator Gordy, did you have a follow-up comment?
Well, I had the question about use of reserves.
Yes, Madam Chair. Senator Gordy, are you referring to hospital reserves? Or when you say reserves, I'm not sure which, I'm not clear on what you're going for here. What's your question directed at?
What is the board policy on use of reserves, and has there been discussion about applying any of the reserves to these programs that are in jeopardy? It strikes me that the underfunded programs in jeopardy go to the core mission of the university, which is to serve, which is to provide services to the underserved. And so I'm wondering how that issue has surfaced as a board discussion.
I see.
If at all. And again, in these tight budget times, if there has been board discussion about how to apply reserves to ensure that the core mission is maintained.
Madam Chairman, Senator Gordy, let me comment, and then I think Dr. Halleck may wish to jump in. We have been, for the last 6 or 8 months, as the clarity and the economic conditions have been coming and our strategy focus has been, we've accelerated on what our responses could be, have kept the board informed of the risk and the strategy directions that we have been taking. Dr. Halleck may want to comment on overall how the mission dialogue may evolve, but we have been very tried to be very clear with our board at what we think are the programmatic risks that we are going to have to pursue, including, as we'll talk about in a second, how we manage the access question, given the very large responsibilities that we've historically had for the underserved and the disproportionate amount of our capacity that is dedicated to that mission. How much of that can continue given the eroding subsidy and reimbursement that is associated with those populations now? Is there how much can you afford to do question there? But Leslie, maybe you want to
just add one additional comment. There are a couple different ways that you can seek reserves. The institutional is one, and the foundations are another. The institutional reserves are underfunded currently, and we could bring you detail on that. One of the ways that Wall Street, when you bond, looks at your reserve capacity is in days of cash on hand and figures like that, but that have to do with your operation. But in general, the institution is under-reserved, and so it's complicated consideration because you're kind of at risk there in terms of your debt service if you go below a certain mark. So I don't want to leave the impression that there's an excess in reserves. We're underfunded in that category and haven't been able to really net deposit into them at a sufficient rate to bring us above that, especially this year given the net impact on the hospital. But there's another resource that is very helpful in this regard, and that has to do with the foundations. It's not exactly a reserve, but particularly for children, the Dornbecker Foundation is quite effective at fundraising, and there the percent of families that are really socioeconomically challenged is much higher, and there the fundraising from the donor base is really pretty effective. So that's an area where we've been able to help to some extent. I mean, it doesn't, you know, cover the whole gap, but it does help. So wherever we can, we've tried to protect this core mission of treating the underserved. But you can see kind of the pressures coming from all directions here, and as we try and grapple with how much capacity do we have for the underserved. It's a real struggle to try and prioritize which groups are sort of our highest core underserved program, and we tend to focus on children, but not exclusively.
Well, Madam Chair, as a follow-up, I would like to see that detail on the reserves, and then also just make the observation that providing services to the underserved, while it is a core mission of OHSU, it's also the last item on the list. And I don't know if that's a prioritized list. My assumption is that it is a prioritized list. And so I'm concerned about what becomes expendable when we are, again, in tight budget times, and whether there would be a disproportionate impact on those who are underserved, looking at the bigger picture. That's my concern.
Is that a question or a concern?
It's both.
Would you like to have them attempt to address that
this
time?
Yes, I would. Thank you.
Would you care to go there?
Madam Chair, let me maybe we should speak about our last slide. Because I think what we've tried to assess as we look at the economic conditions around us and the long-term financial stability of the hospital is the size and commitment of service to that population sustainable and the trend lines and the forecasts that we're on. And what we tried to estimate on this slide is what kind of service scale are we talking about to just stay even with the economic climate that we were trying to build in order to continue to grow the OHSU. And we looked at it, what we said to ourselves is it would take 3,500 admissions given the reimbursement for Medicaid and self-pay that exists now, to be reimbursed at a rate comparable to everybody else in the marketplace to just stay even. It's now a scale of 3,500 admissions. Or that, with that kind of environment, that almost 10,000 or 9,000 ambulatory visits would have to be shifted from Medicaid self-pay to a reimbursement consistent with everybody else in the marketplace to just stay even on this. The access concerns that represents is a significant one. That's just to stay balanced. And so we are looking at a variety of strategies. Our cash and carry policy that I mentioned a minute ago in the prescription area, we're calculating effects about as many as 52,000 transactions at the counter, given the size and scale of our ambulatory pharmacy operations here. So we're trying to maintain access, but access and continue the core mission of the programs, but we also acknowledge that the very large and disproportionate amount of our capacity that's directed to a population that's eroding significantly in its reimbursement means we have to be very thoughtful about what is the size and scale and number of programs and admissions that we can accept in those areas and still maintain viability long term. So the dialogue is very open, but what the intent at the last slide here is that we're in an area where there's some large-scale numbers that need to be understood in order to maintain our long-term stability at OHSU. Is that going at where you wanted to go, Senator Gordon?
Somewhat, yes. Yes. We can move on.
Okay.
Mr. Bender has an issue that he wishes to raise.
Wanted to point out to the committee that there are a number of things going on here, and I think this relates also to Senator Gordley's questions. And that is, as you've been hearing, the reimbursement that the hospital is getting for its Medicaid patients and also for the Medicare patients is going down. And they're becoming essentially more costly to treat because there's a bigger gap between what the institution is receiving and what is actually costing them to take care and to provide the patient care for these services, for these patients. And on the slide that you see up that's being displayed now, they're talking about, well, you know, we have to make adjustments because of this additional loss. But at the same time, another thing that's going on is the board has made decisions about where they want to take the hospital program financially. And you may recall yesterday one of the charts was showing those lines that were showing the rates of return. The board has as a goal to increase the rate of return on hospital operations to essentially a 6% net rate of return, which is higher than it has been. So the combination of those two things, when you have a situation where it's harder to maintain even your existing rate of return because of the reduction in the funds that you're receiving on a great large proportion of your patients, plus the fact that you then want to increase that rate of return higher, that's causing OHSU to look at its patient mix. I think it may be helpful to the committee if the institution could sort of break down those two elements that are going on. So what would the situation be like if you did not increase your rate of return but were willing to continue with the net rate of return that you've been having, as opposed to, you know, trying to increase that rate of return in this particular budget environment where reimbursement for Medicaid patients and Medicare patients is not as favorable as it has been. And that might be something that would be helpful to the committee to get a better understanding of the different elements that are resulting in these outcomes.
Dr. Halleck, would you comment on that?
We will be happy to bring that breakdown back. I want to clarify one thing, and it's probably just a different way of describing what Mr. Vander just described. What the board is asking is that is what the bond market requires of us because of our indebtedness, and that is that we maintain a 3% margin, basically. And so what we've tried to do is carry the unfunded mission of the program with things that are funded and balance the two. So the sort of simple-minded way we describe that is that to reach 3%, which was that flat line in the complicated slide, we're assuming the academic side, the educational side, will be at 0 and the hospital will be at 6. That's just a metric. What matters is the overall institution. We haven't achieved that goal. It would be a nice one to achieve. We did one year, the year that the MUPL reimbursements were strong. But in general, we're below that. It's a fragile relationship with the debt service to sustain a program below that, which is also how we stay in business. So it isn't that we want to be a profit center. It's that we want to sustain the unfunded programs and keep them balanced. So we'd be happy to bring the detail back of all those dynamics and try and depict them in a little bit easier to understand way. It's a complicated combination.
Follow-up, Mr. Bender?
Senator Mesrabi. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to get a better handle on the big picture here. Of the screen we have up now, could you tell us the total number of admissions and ambulatory visits and right on down the list?
Madam Chair, Senator Mesrabi, we have in total about 25,000 admissions. We are close to 550,000 ambulatory visits. We'll accept in terms of transfers statewide, we'll be close to 3,000.
And how about the prescriptions?
I don't know that total offhand. I apologize. We can get that to you.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to try to look at the big picture, too, if I can, for a moment. The discussion this morning has been about cuts at OHSU to balance your budget. And I would suggest to you that that is the same conversation going on in this building and across the state. And it is a situation and the discussion is going in the wrong direction. You cut your admissions and you cut your ambulatory visit and you cut your prescriptions, those people are going to show up back on your door anyway. But this time they won't have taken their medications, they'll have convulsions and they'll be in your intensive care unit. You're going the wrong direction here. You need to take the positive attitude that Dr. Kohler talked about yesterday. This is a problem of revenue. You need to find a way to bring your Medicaid rates up to your full cost. I've not heard a discussion in detail about what you're doing about becoming a fairly qualified health center. I haven't heard a discussion about what you can do to get a better Medicaid rate match. How you can bring more money into the Medicaid program in order to balance it out, since you're so heavily impacted by it from other organizations, in comparison to other organizations. Those kind of discussions I don't see in this book. I'm afraid that's where the discussion really needs to go, because this is not going to fix your problem. You're doing the same thing that every hospital in Portland is trying to do. You're trying to change your patient mix. You're trying to get rid of the people that don't have insurance. You're trying to get rid of the people that are Medicaid so you can make your bottom line. Emmanuel's going to do that. St. Vincent's going to do that. Providence is going to do that. It isn't going to work. It's not going to work. Those people are going to show up there to be taken care of again, and they'll be more expensive. The whole thing is running in the wrong direction. And deep down inside, we all know that.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to protect your institution because you guys have taken the biggest hit. So what I'd like to hear from you, not today, at a later time, where are you in becoming a fairly qualified health center? What part of your population does it cover? Is it ambulatory? Is it inpatient? Is it the entire picture? What have you thought about in ways of bringing down more Medicaid match? Have you talked about user fees? Have you talked about any of those things yet? I haven't heard that today. Because I don't think this is your answer. You'll be back here in a year or two with a worse problem on your hands. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair and Representative Bates, I appreciate the spirit of your comment and understand that we'd be glad at another time to share with you revenue side strategies, the federally qualified health center strategy, which we're actively pursuing, and we have been actively engaged with OMAP. To use our quasi-public status for matching purposes and in ways, and have made specific proposals to those folks in the spirit of exactly where you're going. And we'd be glad to share those with you offline if you wish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that might be interesting for this body also.
I think that it has to be a part of the discussions that we have in relation to your budget, and I think that you very eloquently made the point, Representative Bates, that these people are going to show up for care in the most expensive part of the process, and that if we aren't building something in to account for that, then you're going to be back here again in 2 years or maybe in another year if we only appropriate the first half of your money, wanting us to address those issues again. So I think that it does behoove this committee to get into that discussion about how you are internally talking about addressing the issues, that the need for the care doesn't go away. Senator Masery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. From the figures you just gave me on the total admissions and visits and transfers, if my math is correct, admissions is a reduction of about 1.4%. Ambulatory visits is a reduction of about 1.6%. But statewide transfers is a reduction of a little over 9%. Could you explain why that is?
The Madam Chair, Senator Messler, the look that we're taking at transfers is to assure that we continue to accept from around the state, as our early graph showed, those emergency and tertiary referrals that can't be sustained in the community. Community hospitals across Oregon are just not equipped to do those, and we'll continue to provide that support. We've also taken a hard look, though, at what might be transfers that are relate to services that can be available in those communities or across systems, delivery systems, that still can be maintained in those communities. And the number here of 275 represents our look at, based on the data that we look at, and we listen to every transfer center call every night, to examine the question of why should we be facilitating transfers for patients out of communities when services could be available in those communities. And we have estimated in that regard that there may be as many as 275 or 300 transfers that represent transfers for services available in other communities, but may have more of an economic nature to them than clinical nature to them. And there was not a 9% versus 1% figure here. I would say, to clarify one other issue, is the 3,500 admissions, if you look at Medicaid and self-pay as a portion of the total, is a very large number. We have about 12,000, I think 13,000 of our 25,000 admissions are Medicaid and self-pay. And so 3,500 out of 12,000 is a big number. And that's what concerns us as you look at the scope in that regard. But we're trying to focus on the transfer question for the non-emergent, which is clearly an obligation and responsibility that we will fulfill, and the non-tertiary, a specialized service kind of transfer that OHSU is designed to service, but transfers for services that are of the kind of services that are available in other community sites or delivery systems around the state.
Thank you.
Before we get back into your presentation, I would again like to welcome Senator Gordley's understudy and for another go-round on the OHSU budget presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please proceed.
Madam Chairman, I think that concludes the comments that we intended to make this morning, and be glad to answer any additional questions you have.
Additional questions or comments? Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned self-pay a couple of times, and I wondered what percentage of the Medicaid and self-pay population, and what are those rough numbers, and how much does the sort of self-pay often turn into no pay?
Sure. Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative March, about a quarter of that population falls into the self-pay category, and of that, about 10% of them actually pay some portion of their bill.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Representative March, I see that you also have a job shadow. Would you like to introduce your job shadow to
us? Yes, this is Max Gayar. And he's from Kelki Middle School, but he's also went through the French American School.
Welcome. Glad you can join us today.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
Let me ask you one last question, probably. Let you get out of here, I promise. How in the world do you plan to tell people when they call from Coos Bay or Medford or anywhere else, that we're not accepting that transfer. We think it's a financial transfer. How do you plan to handle something like that?
Madam Chair, directly, we are very careful to make sure physician to physician that all of the clinical evaluation of that patient is done by clinicians, not administrators. And the judgment of whether there's a specialized service required or not is a clinical decision, not a fiscal or administrative decision.
Ma'am, I'll also make a comment. I try to avoid land wars in Asia. That's all I'll say.
Okay.
I mean, as a clinician, I know what you're going to be up against. Have a good time.
Yeah.
Okay. Jeez.
Well, and I would really challenge the reality of your efforts to lower down the referrals that you get. I'm not sure how well that's going to work out. I know that as we've tried to grapple with the budget shortfalls, we've done things like trying to move the classifications for Medicaid that are eligible for coverage, and the system just won't allow that to happen. You have people that, for whatever reason, reclassify those people into classifications that put them into service, and so you don't realize the savings that you're projected to save. And my fear is that your strategy for reducing your costs isn't really going to end up reducing your costs for those same kinds of reasons.
Madam Chair, thank you for your thoughts.
Further comments or questions? With that, we'll allow you to proceed to your next section.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We will bring back follow-up on these questions. I just want to reassure the committee and Representative Bates in particular that the first thing we have pursued in all of these is actually additional reimbursement and the revenue side of the equation. And we've actually shared our legal advice with the fiscal analyst in OMAP on that match that he would like us to increase. So we've actually had consultants look at the opportunity to increase that match.
And Representative Bates, it's exactly what you said. We've hired consultants to look at that match and have shared their legal opinions with OMAP in terms of how to extend that match to bring in more resources. Ultimately, the people need the care. And so we're trying to find the resources to do that. In the meantime, we won't be there if we don't figure out how to meet payroll, so we have this sort of dilemma, but absolutely going after the match is the first thing we've done, and as Mr. Bender can attest, because he has a copy of the same legal advice, we've brought that forward. Everyone's really overwhelmed right now in their ability to process this information, I think, but we very much do want to pursue that. To my right is Dr. Brian Rogers. He's a pediatrician. We're delighted to be able to recruit to replace his predecessor, Dr. Jerry Sells, who previously was the director of the CDRC, or the Child Development and Rehabilitation Center. Dr. Rogers and Dr. Sells are, in fact, the two national leaders in this field. So when Dr. Sells decided to retire, he actually helped us cajole Dr. Rogers into moving from Buffalo, New York. Probably didn't hurt that it was December when we were doing this recruitment, but I'll let him speak to that. But we were delighted that he's come to OHSU. In the short time he's been here, the Child Development Rehabilitation Center over the past year has blossomed, frankly, and one of his particular skills, I apologize if I'm embarrassing you, Brian, is that he brings out the best in staff. And so the people who work in the CDRC are energized, excited, not that they weren't before, but it's amazing to me the productivity enhancements and the changes that we've seen already. So it's a particular pleasure to share with you, Dr. Rogers.
Welcome, Dr. Rogers. Thank you for sharing your time with us today.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure to be with all of you. What I'd like to do is this morning in a brief time is to give you an overview of the work that we're doing at the CDRC for the state and all our patients, and review with you some of the challenges that we've met in some of the future plans that we have, and be able to answer any questions you have for the CDRC. The first slide emphasizes, I think, what I want to just point out to you is that this, we're called the Child Development and Rehabilitation Center, but we really are providing a lifespan approach for disability. So in other words, we see children and adults with the diagnoses that you see on the slide here with a wide range of disabilities, from infancy through adulthood. Most of our clinical services are based for children. Many of our grant programs that are primarily community-based are directed towards adults. So it really covers a wide range of disabilities. Our next slide. This slide, what I just want to point out to you on this slide is the fact that our this pie chart, first of all, looking at our total budget for 9901, 50% of our budget is primarily clinical revenue, and then 28% is grants, and 21% in 9901 was state support. And as you can see in 03, our grants projects have overall clinical revenue has remained about the same. Our grants have increased from 28% to 32%, and state appropriations has been reduced down to 16.3%. Our next slide. In terms of our services, I just wanted to give you a general synopsis of the type of work that we do. In 02, we provided over 30,000 services to over 7,000 children and young adults throughout the state of Oregon. It's important to note that most of our services are majority of our services are provided outside of the general Portland area. And our major clinical consultation sites in terms of our specialty programs are provided both in Portland, Eugene, Medford, Grants Pass, Klamath Falls, and Roseburg. Certainly that doesn't limit our the we provide other programs beyond these sites, but our key clinical programs are in those sites throughout the state. Next, in terms of how we provide the services, I think the points that I want to make to you is that I believe that the types of services are unique. They're not duplicated elsewhere in the state of Oregon. We have over 11 different specialty clinics, primarily multidisciplinary in nature. I think that in terms of our, we have over 20 professional disciplines and over 80 faculty members at CBRC. The majority of the services, near two-thirds of the services that we provide to children and young adults, comprise services that have 3 to 4 professionals to see the patient at one setting, so that we really make a big emphasis on coordinated care and trying to get all the needs of the child and young adult properly addressed at the time of their visit. This is an expensive, complex mission, but we feel that we have a very unique position in the state to provide services for patients with special health care needs. Next slide. That sort of gives you a summary of our direct clinical services, but we also partner with the health division in that CDRC, as many of you may know, we're the program for children with special health care needs, the Title V program, the component for children with special health care needs for the state of Oregon, and we administer that program. And that program has 3 major components. The Cocoon program, which is a model that essentially addresses a public, uses public health nursing throughout the state of Oregon. Our Community Connections program, which are a series of community-based multidisciplinary clinics that we oversee, but we really mobilize community resources, in other words, community professionals from local schools and social workers and others, so that we really bring the services to the community and work with community members, those who know the best in terms of what the services are available to children, work very close with primary care physicians in that effort. It's a model that has been used nationally in terms of our the Community Connections program in a community-based model for care for children with special health care needs. And then finally, another program, and this is really a safety net, and it's called our Family Support Program, and this is funded. Title V, as you're aware, is a federal state match. It's a 4-3 match. And we also provide, with our parent support program, direct help to families, financial support, where you have that net where families are not getting insurance coverage for certain equipment, certain direct services. We used to have a program that was even paid for surgical services and some more direct health-related services. Right now, we've redesigned the program to be more enabling, transportation costs for families, some appliances, and some basic equipment for families. And so we're using that program for direct support to families. Next slide, let's see. This slide here, this is a very busy slide, and I just wanted to show you that if you look at those little figures on the map that almost look like butterflies, those are our Cocoon sites, in other words, public health nursing outreach to various counties. And then the big C's are our Community Connection program. And I think we also have, again, on this slide, our subspecialty clinics throughout the state. But I think the purpose of this is just to emphasize the statewide outreach for our programs and that we work very closely with community providers. Our next slide. This is a slide that, I mean, what I want to emphasize to you is also our academic mission. And as Dr. Halleck said at the beginning, we're sort of a microcosm in terms of some of this, our overall mission, which includes both research, training, and direct service. The uniqueness, I think, when I came here to Portland is looking at our clinic services. And the reason why I came here and why I'm so excited about the future is the fact that this is a statewide community-based effort in terms of our clinical services. But our research is also community-based. We bring in over $7 million a year in federal grants. As I said initially, these grants are primarily clinical research grants that are community-based, looking at different types of community-based models for providing services. And some of the programs that I just want to mention, self-directed supports over this past year, we have programs supported by federal grant dollars promoting independent training and employment for over 3,000 citizens in Oregon. We have a program centered around Americans with Disabilities Act. We conducted over 150 annual statewide conferences. And we also conducted mental health training to over 500 state employees in various programs. Employment training. We assisted and worked with communities to help 600 youths in attaining with special needs to obtain high school diplomas. And then our graduate training program, we have students from all over the country coming for specialized training in disabilities. Most of the training in disabilities are in pediatrics, but also in adult model disabilities. And we've been running that program, and in fact, as you know, the training at CDRC has been in existence over 35 years, and we're one of the more recognized programs for interdisciplinary training for professionals, many of which stay in Oregon. I wanted to next review with you some of our budgetary issues. This slide, what I wanted to give you an idea about is really focusing a discussion on our clinical services. You know, remember that the first slide, the pie chart in terms of our budget, is our overall budget. But I wanted to give you an idea that unique service that I was sharing with you in terms of the multidisciplinary larger teams to see children and families and more care coordination. When you look at the slide in 02 and 03, the slides in terms of expenses, our expenses have gone up a little bit. We're addressing that. Our revenues, this revenue bar, is comprised of both our clinical revenue, which when we see patients takes up about two-thirds of our clinical revenue. The other third is comprised by both state support and some federal grant dollars to help us provide the unique services. When we look at a little bit more in terms of the details of that, the next slide will show you a pie graph. And the pie graph basically shows you the types of clinical revenue streams for those direct clinical service programs, two-thirds and one-third. In other words, two-thirds clinical revenue and one-third grants and state support for our unique services. The point I want to make is that our clinical revenues essentially have gone up, so we've become more efficient. And when you look at the numbers of services that we have provided over a convenient time period from 1994 to 01, our clinical services, in spite of reductions in general state appropriations to the CDRC, our general state services from 94 to 01 have gone up 50%. 50% in terms of increased services in spite of decreased support from primarily state appropriations. What we've had to do, and the next slide will emphasize this to you, is we've had to change a little bit and really done things differently in terms of how our service is. And basically what we've done is we reconfigured and redesigned some of our clinical programs recently, both with this year's budget and threatened or at least at-risk efforts in terms of some of our programs. And I just want to emphasize a few of these issues. In terms of our Portland office, most of our changes have been redirections, in other words, utilizing resources that are available elsewhere. So, for instance, our orthopedic clinic that we ran for years at CDRC, we've been forced to have to refer the children to another pediatric orthopedic clinic at OHSU. It just somewhat affects our team approach. In other words, we're not being able to do everything under one roof. Our purchase care program, we've had to reduce some of the funding for directly to families. and some reductions, potential reductions in terms of children with birth defects in our Portland office, with some more subspecialty care, again, being referred out and not having it all into one team that we used to do. Next slide. We also have some potential reductions and one real reduction in the mental health services that we provide to children with disabilities from some, for instance, our psychiatrist and social work lines at CDRC. And then finally, the other programs that we've had to consider and most likely will need to redesign is our program in Eugene, and having children that we used to have potentially receive subspecialty surgical services in our Eugene office primarily being asked to utilize subspecialty services in Portland. That just gives you an overall synopsis of some of our efforts, and I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Before we entertain questions and comments, Senator Mesley, I believe you have a job shadow to introduce to us.
I do. Excuse me, I do, Madam Chair. With me today, as well as yesterday, is Keenan Farrar, and he's also from Gilkey.
Welcome back. Now, questions or comments? Well, you got off the hook.
And it's only because it's 10. We're letting him off, okay?
Because he promised not to.
I promise not to ask any more questions, and I'm holding myself.
We're going to work very hard in terms of continuing our mission and providing special services to children, but I think that it's a unique service that we need. We look forward to working with the legislature because we need your support and appreciate the support that you've given us in the past.
Thank you very much for your time. Dr. Halleck.
Thank you. I would like, with the approval of the committee, to shift gears now and begin to talk about the educational mission at OHSU. This represents approximately 83% of the investment that you make in OHSU. We think it's a good investment. We want to share with you what's done and some of the metrics by which we measure how we're doing in the educational programs at OHSU. This is just a very high-level overview of the people that we train and a series of mostly degree programs at OHSU. We have schools really in dentistry, medicine, and nursing. In the health professions, we also have several allied health programs that tend to be embedded within those three schools. We've recently merged with the Oregon Graduate Institute, now called the OGI School of Science and Engineering. That school is on the West Campus out on the Hillsboro-Beaverton border and basically educates graduate students in science and engineering areas. And then we have a large number of trainees who are not seeking a degree per se. They're mostly post-degree students acquiring experience in their chosen professions. You just heard a little bit about CDRC. That's an area where at any given time there may be a couple of hundred trainees in residence at CDRC. They may be dentists, nurses, doctors. They can be audiologists, a variety of different kinds of people who want experience dealing with kids who have special health care needs. And so in addition to the standard what are called house staff or the residents, the medical residents who work in the hospitals, we spoke a little bit about them yesterday. Those number over 500, and those individuals have training in specialized medical areas, and the government, the federal government, reimburses us for training those individuals through the Medicare program, which is kind of an interesting quirk of U.S. history, that residents in training and to be physicians in specialized areas are actually reimbursed through the program attached to the Medicare reimbursement program. Postdoctoral fellows are trainees in the sciences, typically working in laboratories, advancing their training postdoctoral degree to conduct research. So that's kind of a very broad broad view, if you look, we'll look within the schools now and look at each of these programs, not in great detail, but at least at a high level to give you a sense of who we are. It's not a typical undergraduate campus. In fact, the only undergraduates we have are in nursing and a handful of undergraduates in specific allied health areas. For the most part, it's a graduate and professional training opportunity for students in the health and science areas. How do we measure ourselves? I'm sorry.
Representative Bates.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a couple of questions just so my own mind can be clear about things. In your School of Dentistry, you've got 277 Doctor of Dental Medicine. Is that all 4 year of your classes?
It is.
So how many of you graduate a year, roughly?
68 or 9. So 70. The class size is 70. We're actually looking at whether we can increase it by 2 or 3. You're limited literally by chairs in dentistry, so it's really very equipment intensive, and so 70 is our class size.
10-15 years ago, how many were graduating?
Same. It's actually
been... When's the last time you had a substantial increase in the number of dentists being graduated from school?
When's
the last time you had a substantial change in the number of graduates from your School of Dentistry?
It's actually gone the other direction. It's been very constant for the last decade. The decade before that, we actually had a larger class size, and during an 80s budget reduction, we reduced it slightly. But it's been pretty constant for a long time.
Madam Chair, do you perceive that we have a shortage of dentists in the state?
Our data indicates, and I'll be happy to share that we are about to have one. It isn't quite as upon us as the nursing shortage, but if you look at the demographics of the state and the average age of the practicing dentists, it does appear that a shortage will be coming. It depends. There's some regional shortages certainly now. We believe that we need to increase this class size. The building was built in the 40s, and we're very much constrained by capacity right now to increase the size, but would very much like to do so to meet the need. And there are half a dozen states around us that don't have dental schools, so the pressure is regional, and we think possibly there are regional resources that might be brought to bear on expanding the class size at some point.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you perceive there's a problem with low-income people receiving dental care in the state, and there's a shortage of pediatric dentists in the state?
We do. There's a shortage in general for low-income access, and as you know, in the Oregon Health Plan, that's an area that may be impacted. And so that's the overall a problem. Pediatric training is certainly an area that we would like to emphasize. And as you're aware, over time, we've looked at the costs associated with a specific residency, that is post-degree training. We do train in pediatrics within the Doctor of Dental Medicine. They have pediatric training. But in addition, one can go on and obtain essentially enter into a residency in dental medicine for pediatric patients and obtain specialized credentials. We don't have that program, and we've looked from time to time at federal resources to mount it. We did at one time have it, and we would very much like to restore it if we had the money to do so.
Madam Chair, just to have some warning here, I'm going to be asking these same kind of questions about a lot of your programs, and I don't want you to take this as an attack. I want you to take this as a positive. My personal feeling is that from what I see in the field every day is that we have been living on borrowed time in health care in this state, that we're not producing enough graduates in any of our schools. We did a better job in the 1950s and 60s than we do now. And I think the figures I want to see is I don't think the medical school has graduated more medical physicians now than we did in 1950, and the population has tripled or quadrupled in the state. I think this committee and needs to know those things, and I don't hear those things coming out of you, so I'm going to drag them out of you.
Okay? Well, you won't have to drag too hard. It's music to my ears. The capacity needed is somewhat overwhelming, and we can share the demographics with you, particularly as the population ages. That need is acute, and it's certainly true with one academic health center in the state. The production does not meet the population as a whole in terms of their needs.
Last question, mm-hmm. Dentist school. If you look at the number of dentists in the state, what percentage of them graduated from the school, and what percentage of the school's graduates stayed in the state?
The first question I can answer. The second, I might have to do some homework. About 80% of the licensees in the state are graduates of OHSU's dental school. Most of them stay in the state, but I can't give you a precise percentage off the top of my head.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you very much. So that we might better understand if how we are achieving diversity or if we are achieving diversity, it would be helpful to see the student demographics disaggregated by gender, race, and ethnicity. And in the future, if all demographic information could be disaggregated in that manner, again, it would be very helpful so that we know how we're doing on our goal of achieving diversity.
I appreciate it, and actually some of that is in the slides to come. This was, and maybe not all, and we'll be happy to do that.
Please.
This is just to give you a sense of the overview. I'll now talk about each of these individually. When I do, we'll bring to you specific measures in each program, and I'm obviously not going to do all of them in the interest of time, but where it's important, we'll try and highlight ways we measure how we're doing. The traditional measures that you hear from educational institutions tend to be enrollment, graduation rates, sometimes retention either through the whole program or into the second year. Those aren't terribly relevant for us. We do them, but actually those measures are very good. It's very competitive in terms of entrance, gaining entrance into these programs. They tend to be very capacity limited. As a result, most of the students who come, partly because they're screened and they're so well qualified, stay and complete the program. Typically, 97-98% actually end up graduating, and where there's a problem, it's almost always a health problem or a family emergency where we work with them to let them stop out for a year if that's what it takes to help them finish. So those measures don't really tell the story. The applicant pool tells you quite a bit, and you'll see applicant pool for dental and medical and nursing programs. Its size, we fare very well in this area. We're very well regarded nationally, and I'll give you some numbers. The quality of that pool, of course, is what counts, and so they're entering GPAs, their test scores, where scores exist in medical and dental school, give you a piece of that, and so we'll try and give you a feel for the quality of our students. How they do in licensure tests is a measure that's frequently used in health professions. We do have an advantage in measuring outcomes here over a generic institution, an undergraduate institution, in that they have to take a national exam in most cases, and so we know how we're doing at least against that measure, and you can argue whether it's a good measure or not, but it is a measure that holds you up against your peers in terms of the knowledge base of these students. The residency match is what happens when medical students leave a medical school and go into specialized areas, and there's a national match as they elect their specialties. It's a very large computerized process. There's a day in March called Match Day, and when you find out the results of the match, and these residents are chosen, and it's a two-way choice. Medical students in their last year go around and look at these programs, and they choose their favorite program, the one where they would like to go first, second, and third, and the programs interview them and submit their choices of which students all over the country they would like to take. You'll hear a little bit about, and you heard a little bit from President Kohler yesterday about how we fare in terms of people choosing us. We'll give you some recent data on how our medical student graduates are doing in being chosen in their first or second or third choice. Diversity is clearly a performance measure, and in response to Senator Gordley's question, it is a measure. It's one we take very seriously. It's a struggle. It takes investment. It takes focus, and we'll tell you a little bit about what we've done, particularly in the last few years, to really bring not just numbers but excitement to the program that we have. And finally, of course, what matters is what do these folks do when they're out? How accomplished are they? What kind of lives do they lead? What good do they bring to society? I won't pretend that we've measured that. We would like to have measures for that, but and we attempt to look at it, obviously. But that one is by far the most challenging of the measures. This is not meant for you to read, but you have a larger version of it in one of the appendices. I think it's the second appendix in your book. And it just gives you the enrollment history over since the public corporation and the year before it. And if you're interested in any specific program, you can track what's occurred to it there. And similarly, our graduate degrees awarded each June across a variety of programs, should you be interested in that level of detail. And, of course, I'm happy to answer questions. But wanted to go into the specific programs a little bit today to get you kind of oriented, and then we can continue depending on your schedule. This is just we've tried to use the same format for all of our pie charts here to just give you a sense of what supports the various programs. The dental school has dropped because of the reductions from 31, and because of its own growth, frankly, and increased leverage, from 31 to 24% supported by the state. An important element here is that the clinical component of the dental school actually is a significant source of revenue. And in order to train dentists, they actually have a clinic where they see patients. We set the rate for that service at about 50% of market, so it provides a service for people who are willing to take additional time because they're actually being treated with trainees, so it's a little slower, but it also gives them a 50% discount in terms of the cost relative to a private practitioner. It does provide a revenue source. One of the things for which we're well known across the country in terms of the dentists we graduate is that they have intense hands-on experience. Their preparedness for practice is among the highest in the country. They have 2 to 3 times the actual clinic time in experience when they leave us, and that's one of the reasons that they're so well regarded. We also do well on the traditional measures in terms of the dental training, the pass rate on the national boards, as they're called, Part 1 and Part 2, which refers to the sort of basic science background and your actual clinical knowledge, are very high. We set a record in the country in terms of having 100% first-time pass rate in the regional exam the last few years, and the regional exam is kind of a hands-on. You bring a patient and you actually conduct a filling or a root canal or whatever the required activity is, and we've done very well in those exams as well. Incoming GPA is very high, speaks to the applicant pool, and I'll give you numbers in a minute. We have typically, we're in the top 2, 3, 4 in the country in terms of average incoming GPA. Very competitive program from all over the country, but very highly trained individuals enter into the dental program, and we've received a number of national awards on both the preventive side and the public health side. If you look at just the numbers here, the application pool is very robust. We have over 700 applicants for those 70 positions we mentioned, very competitive. We accept a little over 100 recently. Varies depending on the mechanism of acceptance, whether you can either accept in a rolling way and just keep going until you fill your class, or you can guess how many are going to accept you and over-accept. That's dangerous if you're facility limited, if too many then say yes. So we tend to be a little more cautious. We were a little more aggressive last year. Somehow I lost the dates, but that last year is this current class, and I must have gotten a little carried away revising last night and lost the dates. They're all the same in each of these. I think this gives you a little bit of a sense of the competitive nature of these students. Again, the dental aptitude test is an incoming test that you take to apply to dental school, and I think you can see that the OHSU applicants are well above the national average in terms of how they score on these exams, and in addition, how they do on their entering grade point averages from college. As I mentioned previously, our averaging is between 3.5 and 3.6 the last couple of years in terms of incoming students. Very competitive program. And this is just an example of the pass rates. This is the one I mentioned where we had 3 years in a row, 100%. We had a couple students who had to take it twice last year, and so it dropped a little bit. Important to note here, they do all pass. It's a question of whether they pass the first time or not. That's our measure here. Tuition is expensive. Tuition has gone up over time, along with the tuition in most programs across the state. We've tried to keep the resident tuition as low as we can, but that has also had to increase over time as we've faced various shortfalls and increases in cost.
Representative Bates,
Madam
has
Chair.
A question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Several questions, last slide here. How many non-residents do you have in the program?
It varies. Typically, it's around 30 to 35%. Some years it's been as high as 40. It's not quite that high right now. We try, and I'll show you when we talk about the budget model in detail, to adjust so that the state dollars, we of course, are attributable to the resident subsidy, in essence, of the program. Even there, we have to supplement those dollars considerably. But it's, in some ways, a balancing act.
Madam Chair, what's the total cost of educating a dentist?
It's about $55,000 a year, and we'll the budget model gives you a lot of detail on exactly how that's derived and what those costs are.
What's the average income of a dentist?
Boy, that's a good question. It's very high. It's probably now, of course, it varies tremendously depending on your practice, but it's I can't give you the exact figure, but it's very significant.
Madam Chair, I can't to bring that back to this.
I will. I'll bring it tomorrow.
We're using public dollars to subsidize a program, which is important to the state, which is not serving the low-income part of the state. I can't get dentists in my area to see see patients that haven't got insurance or good money. And we're subsidizing this with state dollars that those people are paying for. What percentage of your school of dentistry is from minority populations?
What percent is for, or what percent of?
What percent of your graduates is minority students?
It's about 12, about 12%.
Could you give me specifically what minority students are involved?
I can. I have to flip ahead quite a ways. Let me bring that back to you, if I might, and I'll give you the exact breakdown across ethnicities. But it's between 12 and 15, depends on the year, and that includes Asian students. If you take the Asian students out of there, it's a much smaller percent. And I'll bring you the exact breakdown.
Madam Chair, you can probably guess my next question is, I want to know what you're doing to recruit minority students.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
We'll bring you the whole program.
Dr. Halleck, we have some housekeeping issues here, and so if you could just finish up on the School of Dentistry, then we'll take the rest of the time to do our internal things.
Okay. I think actually the slides are complete there. What I'd like to leave you with is the sense that we're working in an incredibly efficient way in the dental school. Of the public dental schools in the country, we're either lowest or next to the lowest in terms of state investment per student. We leverage those dollars, in other words, more effectively than any other dental school, public dental school, perhaps but one, depending on the year, in the country. Private schools, which is an interesting sort of corollary to your comment, Representative Bates, have a very tough time. And right now, we've seen dental school closures in this country. All of the closures have been private. And so I think right now the country is really trying to come to grips with this whole concept of facing a dental shortage, what is the public policy question around dentistry? But and it's an important question. They have cost reimbursement, basically. There is no government-sponsored dental care, with exception of a few programs such as the Oregon Health Plan originally contemplated. So it's a very tough question. How do you provide care for individuals who have the need and cannot afford to pay? But what I do want to reassure you is that with the public dollars that are in this school, they are able to leverage more than any other state in the country the number of dentists we can produce with those dollars. And I'll bring you back the specific data that you've asked for.
With that, then, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 5042. And, Mr. Bender, could you catch us up on housekeeping issues?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I distributed this morning a yellow sheet of paper that has the information on the agenda for the subcommittee for the rest of this week and for next week. Part of the reason why I'm doing this for this week is there is a change from the sheet that you had earlier. Note that tomorrow is again scheduled for public hearing on OHSU. I've listed there the Oregon Opportunity Program. They're going to talk a bit about that, but there are a number of other items. They'll be talking about School of Medicine, School of Nursing, and also they'll be presenting to you their program priority lists and reduction option information. So there's a lot still to cover. There's also will also be public testimony tomorrow from people from the public who are interested in commenting on this bill. On Thursday, this is a change from what you had last time. On Thursday, we will not be doing the OUS capital construction budget as had been planned. That is not ready to go at this point. Instead, you'll be having a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2650. That is a bill designed that will deal with certain issues relating to the state school fund distribution, including the payment shift. And there's another item, which I didn't get on this list. There will be an ask for you to review a grant application by the Department of Education for a federal grant. As you probably know, state agencies are not able to apply for federal grants without legislative approval, and this is the committee that provides that approval. If you flip the yellow sheet over, you can see this is the schedule for next week. But a couple things to note. You will be having public hearings on the state school fund appropriation all next week. And then on Wednesday will be a little different than most of your days, because we'll be having two meetings, your regular morning meeting, and then the chair is scheduling a second public hearing on Wednesday in the evening to receive public testimony from people who are unable to come during the regular hours of the committee. Also on Wednesday, I think that it looks like in your morning meeting, you're being bumped, and you're going to have your morning meeting in H174. But we'll remind you about that closer to the day. The evening meeting will be back here this week.
Questions or comments? Representative March.
There's
nibbling accepted here.
As I recall, you mentioned there would be amendments to 2650. Do we have those available yet?
I do not know. I will try. If there are a set of amendments, I will get them distributed to your office.
Thank you.
There is, I believe, two. There is the original bill, and then there's one set of amendments that we'll be putting into the bill. And we will make sure that you have those prior to the meeting. Further questions or comments? Without further business before the committee, the meeting is adjourned, and we'll reconvene at 8:30 tomorrow morning.